British Public Radio. Literature.
Adventures with Words is brought to you by Audible. Try Audible free for 30 days and download any audiobook for free. For your free trial, go to www.adventureswithwords.com/audible.
In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some advice that I've been turning over my mind ever since. Whenever you feel like criticising anyone, he told me, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had. He didn't say any more, but we've always been unusually communicative in a reserved way, and I understood that he meant a great deal more than that. In consequence, I'm inclined to reserve all judgments, a habit that's opened up many curious natures to me, and also made me the victim of not a few veteran bores. When I came back from the East last autumn, I felt that I wanted the world to be in uniform and a sort of moral attention forever. I wanted no more righteous exertions with privileged glimpses into the human heart. Only Gatsby, the man who gives his name to this book, was exempt from my reaction. Gatsby, who represented everything for which I have unaffected scorn. If personality is an unbroken series of successful gestures, then there was something gorgeous about him, some heightened sensitivity to the promises of life, as if we were related to one of those intricate machines that register earthquakes 10,000 miles away. Hello, and welcome to Adventures with Words, where we explore storytelling in all its forms. I'm Rob.
I'm Kate, and today we're going to be talking about The Great Gatsby. This is something that neither Rob or I had actually really read properly, but I'm a really big Baz Luhrmann fan, and obviously the film of The Great Gatsby has just come out, and I really wanted to see the film. And Rob doesn't normally like to see a film of a book unless he's read the book first. So Rob read the book first. I chose not to because I was so worried that I would then be disappointed by the film that I didn't want to risk it. So I went in and watched the film without having read it, but then read the book straight afterwards. And I think we both were really intrigued by what we read and what we saw. And we thought that we would chat about our ideas about those two things with you today.
So I went into The Great Gatsby. There was a lot of resurgence about this, mainly because of the film. Mm-hmm. But everyone says how fantastic, you know, The Great Gatsby is, and it's called one of the great American novels. So I did go in with a little bit of concern that I, you know, would it hold up to the hype. Mm-hmm. Also, it's a very short book.
It is, isn't it?
But as I was going through, I started to really enjoy this. I started saying on Twitter that I deliberately tried to pad it out for as long as I could because I was enjoying it so much. So I think I did it like about a chapter a day. And I was swept away by it. Some of the writing is just so beautiful, and the imagery that it conjures up. And so I feel quite fortunate that I did finish it before the film. So Fitzgerald, he's been described as, he's defined the term of the Jazz Age. So the book's set in 22.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
But when I was reading up about it, it's quite intriguing to know that as he was writing it, his life was sort of falling apart around him. His wife's having an affair and he's doing a lot of drinking. This is when obviously Prohibition was kicking in. So I found myself really drawn by the imagery and the words, and the plot sort of, it took me a little while to work out where this was going, what this was going to be about. I love the fact that Gatsby, you never quite knew who he was. But what did you think of this? Because you read it a lot quicker than I did after the film.
Yeah, I read it like really quickly, right after we watched the film, actually. I don't know. I feel like in some ways I know a lot about the themes behind the book and the ideas, because in the various things which I have picked up, I didn't do a lot of American literature, as in prose literature, but I studied quite a lot of 20th century American drama and quite a lot of poetry when I was at university. So I'd come across themes to do with the American dream, obviously, which is the big thing in the back of this novel. And then, you know, more recently, sort of reading and teaching of Mice and Men, and also, you know, and coming back and rereading and teaching Death of a Salesman. So I felt like a lot of the themes were quite familiar to me, but I think the style of the writing was what was really unique about it, actually, because I think a lot of people have covered these ideas in various different ways, but I thought the use of colour, the use of the sort of particular images that he kept returning to and sort of weaving the story around were really effective. I agree with you. I mean, the plot is not necessarily, it's not action-packed, it's not not a tight plot, but it's more like a series of episodes which he then links together with these sort of bits of the beginning and end of the chapter to say, a few months later, or whatever it was, not a few months, but like, you know, a couple of weeks later, this happened and so on. And it sort of strings these incidents together and it brings out the significance of what happens. And I really enjoyed the way it was written. I really liked the American dialogue, the kind of dialect, the way it's actually written down to sort of put across the accents of the different characters. He's very good on the way that people speak, I think, actually. He's got a good ear for speech.
Also how they behave. There's a great line that stuck with me where Daisy talks softly, so people have to lean in to listen to her.
Yeah.
That's like someone who notices people, I think, who writes that.
Yeah. It's a very sensual. Yeah. It really appeals to your sense. There's lots and lots of colour, and the colours give you a really different mood depending on what he picks out. The sound of people's voices, the textures of fabrics, even things like that. You know, he talks about the different clothes they're wearing, but he doesn't go into lots of detail about fashion, but he does pick out colours, he does pick out textures. And I think you could really picture yourself in that world, actually, with those people.
Certainly for a book, it definitely bombards your senses, I think, in a lot of ways. You've got the dialogue, the clothes. For me, the colour. I mean, there's the famous bit at the end with the green light. We can talk about what that represents. You've got the... I kind of liked the valley, the bit in between West Egg and Newegg, where all the coal is, what they call the Valley of Ashes. I can see that so well in my mind.
That's an industrial zone.
But things like, you know, the green, everything that stands for, I suppose, envy, the green, money is green.
The green dollar. I hadn't thought of that. Of course.
When it comes to things like the parties, you've got silver and gold, all the glitz. This is supposed to be the jazz age, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a lot of blue lawns stuck in my mind.
Yeah, I thought, because obviously you don't really think of a lawn as blue, but then I guess in terms of kind of lush and it's cool, isn't it? It's I think blue is a colour of past and cleanness, isn't it?
Well, certainly the past. We can talk about that as well. Well,
before we go any further, should we say a little bit about what the story actually is? Do you want to explain?
Well, I was reading from the opening lines. So the book is being told by Nick Carraway. He's our narrator. He comes back from the war and he becomes he works on Wall Street selling bonds.
He's a bonds trader.
And he finds a house and he moves next door to Gatsby. He doesn't know Gatsby at the start, but it's this giant, sort of rather elaborate, sprawling mansion.
Nick's house.
Nick has a cousin called Daisy, who's married to someone called Tom. And they sort of, you get the impression that they hadn't seen each other for quite some time.
Yeah.
And he sort of gets introduced to Daisy, who in turn meets Jordan, who's a professional golfer, who may or may not...
Jordan Baker.
May or not have been cheating. And it's sort of, as you're right, sort of slowly starts to unravel. You learn a few things about these characters. Daisy and Tom's relationship isn't exactly what I'd call perfect.
No, it's quite apparent from the very first time he goes around there for dinner that someone is ringing him up and Jordan's implying that it's his mistress. Mm.
And from the beginning, you get to get this hint of who is Gatsby. No one really seems to know who he is or what he's done, or just he's got a lot of money and he's living next door to Nick. And you get a glimpse of these parties. People just turn up to these parties.
It's just, people aren't invited. Yeah. They just arrive.
Except for Nick. He's the only person who gets a party invite, yes. So this all starts to go on. We meet Tom's mistress, Myrtle, who's actually the wife of the husband who owns a garage in the park that's in between West Egg and East Egg, and eventually Nick goes to a party where he finally meets the elusive Gatsby, and then we go on from there. So Gatsby's he's a man of mystery. No one knows who he is. We don't know who he is to start with.
Before Nick actually meets him, he hears these rumours and someone suggests he was a German spy or the Kaiser's personal assassin. And Jordan sort of makes comments where she clearly doesn't believe all the things that have been mentioned to her. It's interesting. Because you get so much, it's a bit like us before reading the book. You hear so much, but you don't know what to believe. And certainly Nick is also, he's not suspicious, but he's not uncritical of what he hears. He doesn't necessarily consider it to be the truth immediately. But I think that, you know, that goes with his kind of opening intentions there, that to reserve judgment, that, you know, he holds back. He observes a lot. He doesn't criticise. He doesn't judge. But he considers all the possibilities, doesn't he? Mm. And I think that allows us to then, we're guided, we obviously get a certain view, it's, you know, it's all first person, but it's not too prescriptive. You know, you can, if Nick's telling us it, you can pretty much sort of trust what he's saying, that this is, you know, this is the truth as far as he can tell at that point.
So we finally meet Gatsby, and we're still not quite 100% sure where he got his money from. But he's absolutely stinking rich. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
And he throws these elaborate parties, but he never quite seems to get involved. He's very restrained, sort of steps back. Now, for me, Gatsby was always the one, this talked about being the great American novel.
Yes.
Saying in air quotes here. So I think Gatsby, obviously, he's the name of the book. This is the crux of the novel. And I think this is what Fitzgerald is getting at, which is the idea of the American dream.
Yeah.
So we start to learn that he's a self-made man. He's come from he's a farm boy. He's changed his name and he's become, you know, this wealthy millionaire through slightly dubious means, as we eventually
they never become 100% clear, but you get a pretty good idea as to what it is.
I think the closest we get is that he owns a lot of sort of pharmacy shops, and there's some bit of booze being going under the table. But I think this is the point, is that the American dream is that anyone can become anything. You can start from scratch and become, you know, make yourself whatever you want to be.
And I mean, it starts off, you know, with the pioneers, people arriving, you know, and it's sort of people like Whitman and so on writing their poetry about it, you know, people, brave pioneers going off into the wilderness, homesteaders, you know, claiming your bit of land, making your home, bending it to you. And it's all about human endeavour.
Yeah.
It's about courage. It's about having the conviction in what you're trying to do, believing in yourself. It's a very kind of Christian soldiers kind of idea, really, that, you know, you're making a way, you're going out there, you are the stewards of the earth, it's up to you to make it how you want. But then obviously that develops into what we call the American dream, and it becomes much more than just having your own home and your way of life. It becomes about the sky's the limit, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think the key point is, the idea is that with money, anything is possible.
Yeah.
And this book shows rather tragically that that isn't the case. Because as we go on to learn that Gatsby and Daisy have a past, he's been in love with her for sort of the last 5 or 6 years. Yeah. Everything he's doing is for her, essentially.
Mm. Yeah, he does become a very, you know, more and more so a very tragic, going from a figure of kind of mystery and intrigue and envy to someone who actually, despite everything he has, really has nothing. It's the dichotomy that goes right through the whole thing. And it, you know, it is a very ambiguous book, because on the one hand, there's this sort of glory of the parties, the wonder of the lifestyle, the cars, the booze, the high-rise apartments of Manhattan, you know, the whole glamour of it. But on the other hand, it's the isolation, the solitude, that actually he's got this great big house. And I think Daisy at one point says to him, how can you live here on your own? But he's got this massive house, but it's never really been for him. He's been always striving, always trying, you know, and he's been caught by love. He says, I think at one point, that it was awful for someone like him to fall in love. Mm. It's kind of captured him, and he's sort of become obsessed with creating everything, creating the right life. But it's really interesting, because obviously, again, you've got that ambiguity. Okay, he's saying he's doing everything for Daisy. I'm not sure I believe that, really.
I think he's a man who's looking for answers, and I think he's just found this one, and he thinks that if he gets Daisy back, everything will be fine. And I don't think that won't solve his problems. I mean, he's incredibly obsessed. I think I get the impression that he finds this house opposite her and that's it, because you can see her across the bay.
Yeah.
And no, I think that Daisy is sort of just, it's an answer, but it's not really the solution for him.
But I think that's the problem of the American dream, because there is no end point. I think it's always been Daisy. Daisy, for him, is supposed to be the answer. And so he gets the money and he does all this, you know, and he's so determined, he's so focused, and he's so ambitious. So he's able to achieve what other people haven't been and accrue this enormous wealth so quickly. because he's trying to make that home for himself, except that it doesn't work out like that. You can't just make someone else feel the same way that you do, because this is the thing. I mean, Daisy's a human being. Mm. She's not money. She's not a bond to trade. She's a person, and she certainly doesn't feel empowered. I think that's the other side of the story, which I thought was very interesting, about the absolute disenfranchisement of women at that time. That you've got Myrtle, who's Tom's mistress, and she gets as much as she can out of him, kind of thing, but she still isn't able to leave her husband, who's in this dead-end job in, you know, running a garage in the middle of a, you know, piles of rubble and ashes. You know, despite the fact that she's got this guy who's so rich and treats her, it's still only a temporary escape. She's still absolutely stuck. And actually, her temporary escape is what, in the end, causes something very tragic for her as well. You've got Daisy, who was really, really privileged, and she isn't allowed to sort of have her own individual life. It's, you know, it's no question that she would get married, and it wasn't Gatsby, so it ended up being Tom. And now she's stuck with him, even though he's a pig.
Well, the thing with Tom is it's all right for him to have an affair, but if Daisy looks at another man, then can't do that at all.
No, and I mean, he's fiercely jealous of her. When they go to parties at Gatsby's, he goes off chasing women, but then turns up drunk later demanding to know where she is. And I think that is very interesting, that supposedly this is an age of liberation. And in fact, it's only an age of liberation if you're a man.
Mm, certainly. I think with Gatsby, he's just basically sort of stuck looking back. He's not looking forward.
Mm.
He's just clinging on to this sort of dream, this moment that he had with Daisy. She's lost.
Yeah, and he doesn't see her, I don't think, as a real person. He sees her as that moment from his past. And despite the fact that, you know, he's got the best cars and the best houses and the most amazing food and wine and decorations and paintings and clothes and all of this stuff, actually he's incredibly backward-looking, isn't he? Mm.
Well, he wants Daisy to say that she never loved Tom. He can't get over that for a moment she did think about someone else.
Mm.
It's this getting back into the past again. He wants to go back to the exact moment where Tom wasn't there. It's just him and Daisy again. And he can't get over that.
No, it's really... you can tell from the way we're talking about it. It's so fascinating. Obviously, there were some spoilers in what we've just said there. Mm. But I actually, having seen the film first and then read the book, I still felt it was very much worth reading the book. So if you haven't read it, I don't think we've actually spoiled the experience of reading it. It is fascinating. I really do think it is. I mean, it's been so much written about. I think there are so many different ideas that people have brought out of it. And we've sort of mentioned a few. I mean, there's television programmes and so on that have been linked to it. I mean, Rob, I know that you were looking at some of the stuff that Sarah Churchwell has had. Is it in The Guardian?
Yes, because she's got a book out now all about Gatsby and Fitzgerald.
Yeah, handily enough.
And that's quite convenient, yeah. So it was more towards the end of Fitzgerald's life that he actually moved to Hollywood. He was trying to make some money. He had his wife's hospital bills and also his daughter's college bills to pay for. And he sort of died writing his last novel, which wasn't finished, called The Last Tycoon, which they were saying is possibly going back towards more Gatsby territory.
Yeah.
And he died aged only 44 as an alcoholic in 1940. So there's a lot of what else could have been. So he went to Hollywood to make his money, so it's probably about now that we should talk about the film.
Yeah.
So I read the book first. So this is the Lerman film.
Yeah.
I went in with absolutely zero expectations, and I was fully expecting to hate it. Now, I think that's because the way it was sold.
Yeah. The trailers were so big and bright and in your face, weren't
which
they?
Is what you expect from Baz Luhrmann, and
yeah,
also it was in 3D. So I've seen Romeo and Juliet, which I thought was actually a perfect adaptation for people our age, because that was aimed exactly at our when we were teenagers when that came out. I really enjoyed Moulin Rouge. I've never seen Strictly Ballroom, but I know roughly the sort of the style of it. I haven't seen Australia, but this was sold more along the lines of a Moulin Rouge and a Romeo and Juliet.
Certainly the trailers, you know, were very sort of incredibly bright colours, all the party scenes.
The music, the pounding music,
The R&B.
Mm. Yeah, straight away. See, you could have got away with the jazz age music, I think, at the time. Because it's still set in the 1920s as well. It's not been updated like Shakespeare was.
No, and I think that's really interesting that I think a lot of people were very critical. A lot of people said it was very, they thought it was quite cold. I don't know. And I think there was a really mixed critical reaction to it when it was first released. Mm. Now, I said at the beginning, I'm a massive Baz Luhrmann fan. When Romeo and Juliet came out in the cinema, I saw it four times in the cinema. I thought, I then went and watched Strictly Ballroom, which I really loved. I then I saw Moulin Rouge twice at the cinema. I've got it on DVD. I absolutely love it. Again, I haven't seen Australia. I don't know why. That just obviously just came out at the wrong time. But I'm such a big fan. I really am. And I think Luhrmann's real genius is to do making films to do with identity. And in Romeo and Juliet, that works because it's two young people who think they know what they want, but actually they're caught up in everyone else's problems and being pushed from pillar to post, forced to do things they don't want to do. In Moulin Rouge, you've obviously got the sort of character played by Ewan McGregor, the playwright, and he's, you know, he's isolated, he's on his own, he falls in love. And again, it's the sort of tragic love story between the two people. So I could really see from what I knew of Gatsby, how that would work with Luhrmann's sort of preoccupations, if you like. But I don't know. I love the spectacle of Moulin Rouge. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And it fitted perfectly with when it was supposed to be, you know, in Paris and Montmartre with the, you know, showgirls. It was completely over the top, quite very camp, very glitzy. But it worked for what it was. I think it really worked. So I thought, do you know what? You know, we'll give it a try. If it's no good, it's no good. But it won't be the end of the world. But I really enjoyed it. I'm not sure, it wasn't what I expected. I think similar to you, I thought it was going to be very like Moulin Rouge, very in your face, you know, partying right through. Because where I've heard reviews of it or read reviews, they focus very much on the kind of party aspect, on the music. They didn't really talk very much about the acting, which I thought was really strange. And some people weren't particularly positive about Tobey Maguire's narration, because obviously Nick Carraway does narrate over the story a bit, and Tobey Maguire actually does that as Nick in the film. Perhaps the way that he speaks it isn't particularly lively, I think. But they sort of use a framing device in the film where he's a recovering alcoholic, and he's kind of sharing his story as part of his process to recovery. So perhaps that's why they do it in that tone. But I thought Leonardo DiCaprio as Gatsby worked really well, and I thought it was interesting casting him, bearing in mind some of the things that he's done previously, actually, because obviously he's, you know, he's been Romeo and Juliet, he's been the star-crossed lover, he's been in Catch Me If You Can, where he's, is it Frank Abagnale?
Yeah, he's a con man
impersonating, well, a con boy, impersonating all these different people, taking on new identities. What's the one where he's the aeroplane tycoon?
Oh, The Aviator, which is one of my favourite films, yeah. Howard Hughes.
Yeah, Howard Hughes. So he's been Howard Hughes, who's the man with all the money but nothing else. So all of those sort
that's
of things.
Kind of been building up, yeah.
Yeah, you can see how they would all lead into playing Gatsby. And then plus, he's obviously got, he's sort of the blonde, blue-eyed, kind of all-American kind of look to him. And, you know, sort of in the film it says, you know, he's 32 or something, whereas in real life he's obviously a bit older than that. But I could see how that all worked. I could really see that casting. And actually, I thought he was brilliant. I thought he was really, really good. Very subtle, you know, not completely trustworthy. He's a very good physical actor. And there are good bits where he's really nervous about meeting Daisy.
That was very good.
He knocks this clock off the mantel. And it's perfect. It's so good.
That was sort of slapstick, almost comedy, that was.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's something else where, being a bit of a Leonardo DiCaprio obsessive, you know, he is able to do that really well. I mean, there's bits in Romeo, there's a great bit in Romeo and Juliet where he skids across the floor at one point because he's in a hurry. And I think all those aspects were used so well. And, you know, I'm not as familiar with the other actors in the film. But I thought, you know, Carey Mulligan was very good as Daisy, and she's, you know, very sort of soft. You know, in the book it talks about her soft voice, and she looks very demure and very sweet and very innocent, like, you know, sort of Southern Belle kind of thing. I mean, I don't know what you thought.
Well, like I said, I went in with basically rock bottom expectations. Even though I'm a Lerman fan, I just didn't understand how he was going to apply his style to this book or film, which is the book is kind of a bit understated compared
to. Yes, it is. Yeah.
But I enjoyed it because it wasn't what I expected. It wasn't what I was sold as I was going in.
Mm.
The parties are very brief. I was almost thinking that there was going to be like long extended music video sort of styles. And the actual music, even though I think I would have preferred they used sort of the jazz age of the time, it did actually work. And I've gone back and listened to some of the soundtrack on Spotify because I quite liked it. I thought, like you, I thought DiCaprio was brilliant. He had that sort of, all those aspects that you mentioned, but also that slightly sinister, there's something sort of bubbling under the surface when he actually snaps at the end. And we've seen that in Django Unchained, he's recently done as well.
Yeah.
Tommy Maguire, Nick Carraway, he's a difficult narrator because you're not quite sure. He's a bit jaded, he's a bit worn out by everything that he's seen. Mm. I didn't really like the framing device. I could see why they're doing it. It was a bit of a way of shoehorning in some of the typed lines from the book, but
that was
fine by me. He kind of sleepwalks a bit through this at times.
He does. I think that I'm not sure that's not a problem with the character itself, though.
Yeah.
Because the point of the character is he is so detached.
Mm.
So he's kind of, it's difficult to create a film with a character like that because he's there watching and not really getting involved that much. And he sort of asks some questions, but mainly he just listens. He's not a very active character.
He doesn't take a lot of...
passive character.
He's, a lot of the time he's just being told what to do. I need you to go and get Daisy and such and such.
Come to lunch with me so and he's not, meet my mistress.
He doesn't really... And occasionally he's like, oh, no, I'm busy. And then they talk him into it anyway. So he's kind of just... he's kind of carried along.
Yeah.
But as your narrator, that's kind of what you need. You need to be told what's happening. So, yeah, Tobey Maguire I wasn't too keen about. But I thought the rest of the film, we saw it in 3D.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
Which is another thing I had a bit like, okay, not quite sure how that's going to work.
Is there any point?
But it did. The look of the film, because we've said before, the book is all about colours.
Mm.
It's about imagery. It's about sort of the sensation that's going on. So 3D actually sort of added to that.
Mm.
And I found myself sort of thinking, this isn't as bad as everyone else was saying it was going to be, and I really quite enjoyed it.
Yeah,
it's
definitely
an interpretation. I kind of wish they kind of met half and half. It should have been a, like, you still set it in the 20s, but it's not quite the 20s, or why you could easily update this to now.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the themes in Gatsby are so relevant now. You've got the boom and bust that we've just had, you know, this obsession with... You can almost imagine it, if this was done now, there'd be paparazzi. It's an obsession with celebrity,
definitely.
With gossip, what's
definitely.
Going on, the rumours about who Gatsby is. So you could have done it that way as well.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And that almost like kind of reality TV stars
yes,
or something,
definitely.
Do you know what I mean? Or even the kind of LA, you know, if you want to go down the R&B route with the excessive space, you know, someone like Jay-Z and Beyonce or, whatever. But then they do use that. I think that's why that kind of music was used. Because you do have that kind of soundtrack and these songs where it's not completely modern, though, is it, the soundtrack? There is the 1920s kind of jazz style, but then it's mixed together with either original modern tracks or kind of or like period style covers.
Mm.
So, I mean, I noticed, as like a bit of Jay-Z, I noticed Amy Winehouse, I noticed Alicia Keys,
Lana
New York,
Del Rey's on there,
Lana Del Rey, these kind of things. But it doesn't jar too much. I think if you're a real traditionalist, then you weren't ever going to like the film anyway,
no,
if I'm honest.
No. But this ends up being sort of almost a dreamlike quality to it. The 3D worked. It's one of the few 3D films I've actually thought, that does actually work. The style of it, the way the colours were all ramped up, ends up sort of having kind of a dreamy, cartoon-like quality to it.
Yeah.
Especially when you've got where it's going from New York through to the Valley of the Ashes. That's incredibly stylized.
Mm.
So it wasn't a complete car crash, no pun intended, what I thought it was going to be. I liked it. There wasn't really... I didn't have any problems with it.
No.
Apart from the slight change to the ending.
Yeah, they...
Or the missed bits
out. Well, yeah, they don't change it, but they don't include everything which is in the book. Now, should we talk about that? Or do you want to leave that?
I think we can leave that.
Okay.
It's only a minor niggle. I was just surprised because I thought it would tell us a bit more about Gatsby in a way.
Yeah, I mean, personally, having seen it the way you'd have seen the film first and then read the book, I didn't necessarily feel that it was a big problem leaving out the bit that they did. But I think it's just that, obviously, Lerman had quite a focused vision about the aspects that he wanted to focus on. You know, and I think some of those things we didn't always think were exactly the same concerns that Fitzgerald had. You know, Lerman, this is an adaptation. It's not just a film of the book. He's definitely adapted it because he has certain aspects he wanted to pull out. I mean, one thing that I thought was quite interesting was that Lerman was interviewed and he said it's a love story.
Mm.
And, you know, that was the thing that he was actually foregrounding, the love story between Gatsby and Daisy. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure I actually agree with
that. No, I think
that.
Reading the book, that's not what you come out of it. It's a tragedy, which I think Lerman is always sort of...
Oh, he's up for a good tragedy.
Oh, he loves those. So, no, for me, it was always more about the American dream and what that stands for. I never quite thought, that's a love story that doesn't happen to end well.
No, I think, I mean, if it's...
You can look at it, but I wouldn't say it's the main...
No, thing. I wouldn't either. And I mean, I expected to come out of the film, because I knew it had a tragic ending. I didn't know exactly what. I expected to come out of the film weeping. I am a crier. I'm a big crier at films, as Rob will attest. But I mean, God, when I walked Moulin Rouge, I was absolutely crying my eyes out. And I didn't cry at this. And I sort of was—I was trying to think about why that was, but I think it's because actually it is a bit more detached. You're not as personally engaged with the characters because none of them you could be completely on side with. You know, Nick, even though he's a narrator, he's very passive.
Mm.
Daisy is sort of sweet and vulnerable, but she allows herself to be manipulated. She says at one point she thinks it's the best thing that a girl can be to be a fool. It's not, you know, you stop thinking about what you're doing, just let yourself be swept away and just get on with it and don't complain, which I don't agree with as an attitude to life. But, you know, I can see why she does, but, I don't agree with that. I think Gatsby clearly loves her, but to the point where actually she has become something else for him to have, you know. So it's not, for me, it wasn't a romantic love story. I think love is the wrong word. I think obsession is the right word.
It's an obsessive story,
It's ambition and obsession and how that can cause you all sorts of problems.
Mm. And it's obsession about a number of things as well. It's not just love, it's clinging on to the past. So,
success, reputation, making progress, correcting your mistakes, kind of,
So one thing that the film does use is it uses a lot of bits from the book, obviously.
Yeah,
you'd have to, directly quoting. And it ends, as the book does, with what they describe as the most famous last lines in American literature. And they're actually inscribed on Fitzgerald and Zelda's gravestone. I think that's obviously how important that became. So this lasting image, we've got the image of the green light at the very end of the book.
But it's been mentioned previously as well, because when Nick first sees Gatsby, Gatsby's on the end of his pier looking out across the water, and he seems to be stretching out his hand towards something. And what we realise is there's a tiny green light, and it gradually is revealed that that's the green light on the end of the Buchanan's dock.
Which they don't even realise is there.
Daisy doesn't even know it's there. But it's become so much more than that to Gatsby. And I think when he sort of embraces Daisy, Nick says that, you know, perhaps he's realising that he's got one less sort of, you know, that green light maybe doesn't make as much difference anymore. He's got one less kind of enchanted thing because he's actually got a bit closer to Daisy. So it's sort of sprinkled throughout, sort of a few references. But at the end, it's full kind of significance is revealed, isn't it?
And it's Gatsby, he's sort of reaching forward back into his past. You can't reach it. So you've got this tension of past and present, going forward, looking back. I think, you know, as last lines go, it pretty much sums up everything in the book.
Yeah, it does. And I think it's so brilliantly worded. It's so unusually worded. And it brings together all those elements. You know, even at one point Nick says to Gatsby, well, you can't repeat the past. And Gatsby says to him, of course you can.
Mm.
You know, and he's got that absolute focused determination.
There's never any doubt.
You know,
yeah.
There's no doubt in his mind. I think, you know, Nick describes him as someone with this enormous capacity for hope. And I think that's a very kind way of putting it.
Delusion, possibly.
Well,
yeah,
exactly. You know, hope to the point of the exclusion of doubt, which obviously isn't healthy. But, yeah, the way that those lines sum it, I mean, that it takes us through all of, you know, like Arthur Miller, like I was saying, you know, Steinbeck, all of these ideas that there is something out there. You can keep going, you can keep trying and keep reaching up to someone, you know, like sort of Don Draper in Mad Men nowadays, you know, one of the most sort of popular American programs, other than Game of Thrones and whatnot.
A bit different.
It's slightly different. But, yeah, you know, someone like Don, and, I mean, I absolutely love Mad Men, and I hadn't really thought of it in the same way before, but some, you know, that character of John Draper, where he's reinvented himself, he's created this position for him, he's got a reputation, but actually he's quite different to Gatsby, because he's not reaching backwards. He's very much just trying to look forwards, and other things pull him back.
Right, yeah.
So he can't escape it, but for a different reason, because there are all these links which still exist, you know, these sort of invisible threads, if you like. But it's that same kind of idea, that same kind of preoccupation with moving forwards while looking backwards.
Hmm. I think that's all, but I have to ask you one more question. Is it The Great Gatsby? We have to talk about the book, I suppose.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, having obviously had lots and lots of hype from people and people telling me it was the most amazing book, I don't think it's the most amazing book I've ever read. I think I've read books which are as good, if not better. Not many. It's a very good book, but I don't know if I would call it The Great Gatsby. I think it's really very good.
Mm.
I mean, what about you?
Well, even Fitzgerald had trouble naming it. I think he didn't want to call it The Great Gatsby in the end. For me, it was never going to live up to the hype. It's the old Wolf Hall syndrome, where everyone says it's fantastic. But I found myself wanting to stretch it out longer, so I think that was a good sign. I think for such a slim tone, it's like 160, 170 pages. You get an awful lot out of that. The plot sort of didn't seem to matter so much at times, but for me, it's the quality of the writing. I mean, I think, yeah, this is
yeah,
all he knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, the prose is stunning. The prose is absolutely stunning. It really is.
So I think it's the not quite Great Gatsby, but I don't know quite what I'd want more out of it.
I know what you mean. I'm not sure what I would change, but it was wonderful. It was such a brilliant thing to read.
And if you do like The Great Gatsby and you're a bit sort of on the fence about the Lerman film, I'd recommend going to see it.
Give it a try.
I mean, I went in with absolutely no expectations. It's not as bad as people say, but it kind of a bit glosses over sometimes. Some people have described it as a bit superficial, but I think it's still Gatsby at heart.
I thought it was actually quite respectful, to be honest. I think I liked the film more than you did, I think.
Yeah. That's safe to say, yes.
I think I enjoyed watching the film as much as I did reading the book, if I'm honest. I think you were kind of a bit more 50-50, but I was pretty keen.
I'd only finished reading the book the day before, and I knew, like, point for point what was going to happen next. It still flung, you know, it still went quite quickly.
Yeah.
Which sometimes when you've read the book or the film, and you're like, this bit's next, and this bit, and this bit, and you know where you are. But no, I mean, yeah. I enjoyed it, but not as much as the book. No,
yeah. I mean, I thought it went far. I thought it went quickly. I thought it was dramatic. I thought the acting was generally very good. I thought the style, the music, and all of that. You know, I really like the kind of people that he works with on the design side. Anyway, at a couple of points, I was actually sort of leaning forward in my seat because I was so sort of engaged in what was going to happen next. But I would recommend the film. I actually thought it was good.
I would recommend it as well. Yeah. Well, do let us know your thoughts on The Great Gatsby, either the book or there's been a couple now film adaptations. You can get in contact with us in a number of ways. We're at adventureswithwords.com on the website. You can email us, contact@adventureswithwords.com. We're on Twitter, @WordAdventures. And you can also like the page on Facebook, facebook.com/adventureswithwords.
If you do subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, do leave us a review. We'd love to hear your comments.
I finally finished Inferno.
Oh,
so I'll be reviewing that shortly. Yeah, I think most people know roughly the tone that that review is going to be on. Have you been reading anything lately?
Oh, God, so much stuff. Absolutely loads of different things. I'm just trying to think all the things I have read, actually. I finished reading Perfect by Rachel Joyce, and I've posted my review up on the website already. I've just finished reading A Noble Conflict, which is the new Mallory Blackman. I quickly fitted in Gatsby in there as well. And I've read The Mark of Athena by Rick Riordan, which is the latest Percy Jackson. I've read something which is called Peregrine, Harker and the Black Death, which is something I had from NetGalley, which is an interesting little story, kind of YA. But we've just had some really nice things in Through the Post, actually. Something called Tall Tales from Pitch End by Nigel McDowell, which is sent to us by Hotkey Books. So that's some YA, which I'm actually looking forward to getting into quite a lot. So loads and loads of bits and bobs to come from us on the website over the next couple of weeks.
I'm about to start Ghost Man by Roger Hobbs. If you want a bit of an eye-opener, just go look at his Tumblr page and see what there is. Kate was a fan, but we'll leave you with this. Gatsby believed in the green light, the orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eludes us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther, and one fine morning, so we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past.
Adventures with Words is brought to you by Audible. Try Audible free for 30 days and download any audiobook for free. For your free trial, go to www.adventureswithwords.com/audible.